Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolving nature of our being, our psyche in particular, and that's something we'll be talking about. What is the nature of the psyche? What is the psyche? And how are we changing in relationship to a greater mind? Tonight's guest is someone who's written a book called Dispelling Watego, Breaking the Curse of Evil, but not evil in the sense that most people think of it. Tonight's guest is Paul Levy. Paul, how are you tonight?
Oh, I'm really good, Alan. Thank you. I'm just really happy to be here.
Oh, thanks. Well, your book about Watego, I guess you call it, right?
Yeah, it doesn't make a difference how you say it, whatever comes easy for you. But
Watego, well, I'll just read a sentence here, is holographically enfolded within the psyche of every human being. The Watego virus pervades and underlies the entire field of consciousness and therefore can potentially manifest through any one of us at any moment if we're not mindful. I mean, what you outline in this book is, in a sense, a thought possession of the human mind. How would you define what Watego is? I know you take 100 pages or more to define in the book, but how would you define it? Because it's sort of hard to put your hands on.
Right, no, and that's its nature. So it's a question that I get asked all the time, like, what is this thing called Watego? And I don't ever know what to say because it doesn't, in a way, lend itself to language or to having any sort of words that can pin it down. So I'll try my best, but it's actually like this, one way of describing it, it's a psycho-spiritual disease of the soul and that exists in the collective unconscious itself. And it's something that indigenous people have been tracking for a number of centuries. And one can think of it as like this, like we get a virus in our physical body. This is an actual mind virus that operates through the psyche, and it operates through the unconscious, and particularly the part of us that we're unaware of, the blind spot. And it will operate through our blind spot in such a way so that we feel compelled to act it out. And at the same time that we're doing that, it hides itself from being seen. Okay, so it works with the projective tendencies of our mind, because we're always projecting. I mean, being that this is some sort of a dream, we're always just projecting onto the inkblot. And Watego actually keys into that dynamic that is happening 24/7, but in a way that it actually feeds itself. So it's like this tapeworm of the mind. Think about when we have a tapeworm in our system. It will get into us, and we start having these cravings for food that feeds the tapeworm, and it gets bigger. And all the while, we're imagining we're feeding ourselves. But as it gets bigger, it more and more is taking over our system and going to ultimately kill us. That's actually one way of understanding what Watego is. And the indigenous people would really refer to it as like it's a spirit of evil. Okay.
But it's just, it. I mean, what you say, and of course it's seen in the world, it is everywhere and in everyone. Everyone has these unconscious parts of them, and we live in a culture that perpetuates the unconsciousness, and it's like the invasion of the body snatchers, right? It's
right. Well, the thing about Watego, I mean, it's really, okay, it's a higher dimensional you could say this dis-ease that it operates through the third dimension, but so it's actually this formless entity that doesn't even objectively exist. When you really inquire into it, it doesn't have any intrinsic actual existence, and yet it can destroy our species. And what that's pointing at is the profound power that all of us have inside of us that we're not aware of. Okay, so what you were just saying is like, yeah, it pervades the entire field, the field of the collective unconscious itself. Its source is in the psyche, And the thing which is interesting about Watiko, so it's something you're totally correct when you say, yeah, any of us at any moment, in the same way that any of us can fall prey to the unconscious and unwittingly act out our unconscious in a way that might be hurtful to someone else or to ourselves. Same thing with Watiko. We can, you know, fall prey to it and have the best of intentions and think we're being all conscious and awake, and unwittingly we are actually acting out the bug and unwittingly being an instrument for it to incarnate in the third dimension. But the thing that I point out in the book that I really contemplate again and again is that encoded in the manifestation of Watiko is its own medicine, that it's actually showing us something about ourselves. It can actually help us to wake up. Okay, and that's really this incredibly important point.
Right, no, that is a point that you go over and over again. You're saying this darkness or the shadow is, in a way, you don't say a gift, but it's for us to wake us out of the delusion of this ego-driven, self-indulgent, what do you call it, the me syndrome, how do you define me?
Yeah, in my earlier book, Mike, I coined the phrase malignant egophrenia, or ME disease, me disease, which is really this misidentification of who we imagine ourselves to be. And that's ultimately, that's this other way of articulating Watiko. Okay. Now, if I can just go back to one thing, the thing about Watiko, you see, it's so hard to pin down because it operates through the psyche, and the psyche is like not just found inside of our skull, but the psyche in physics, they talk about the non-locality of this universe, which is to say that, it's not bound by the conventional sort of laws of third-dimensional space and time. So the thing about Watiko, it operates through the psyche and in the psyche, and yet its canvas, or, you know, the way it elaborates itself, it actually configures events in the outer world to synchronistically express what's going on inside of our psyche. And what I just described, that's exactly this way of describing when we have a dream at night, because a dream, the outer dream is an actual reflection of the inner psyche that's dreaming the dream. That's very, very similar to, you see, so the thing about Watiko, you can't really see it until you begin to realize, oh, we're actually having this shared dream, like all of 7, you know, billion of us are co-dreaming this dream into materialization moment by moment. And then that opens up the doorway to saying, oh, wow, there's a non-local field of consciousness that informs and underlies and pervades the entire, you know, the entire, just the whole planet and all of us. We're all not separate from the field. When you begin,
would you say it's Watiko that is preventing us from seeing the world as a dream itself?
Yeah, well, the thing which is interesting, it's simultaneously an expression of the dreamlike nature, and it's actually revealing to us the dreamlike nature, while at the same time, it's actually obscuring us from seeing it. So it's both. You see, so it's like, and that's the trippy part of Watiko, is that in a superposed state, it has the opposites both combined in it. And how it manifests, whether it's going to continue to destroy our species, or whether we're going to actually see what it's revealing to us and actually wake up, it all depends on if we have the recognition of what it's revealing to us.
Well, when you say it is revealing to us, I mean, you have to, in a way, explain it more, because the uneducated person or people not familiar with this understanding of dreams or the dream reality wouldn't see it that way. So what I get you mean, when someone comes into your field or your world that is acting in some kind of aggressive way or some kind of way that you're not in agreement with, that is really your projection of this Watiko onto somebody else or part of that. Is that right? Is that how you define it?
Well, I would, it's a little bit, you know, that's kind of it. I would just say a little bit more, in the sense that if you see this as if it's a dream. So say if somebody comes into the scene that you're having in the play right now, and they're like acting something out that you don't like, right? Well, on one hand, they're this character in your dream, just like you're a character in their dream. So they're an embodied reflection of that part of you. And simultaneously, if they're embodying something that is triggering you, then at the same time, there, you know, something in you is getting activated, and it's actually, instead of putting our attention out there on seeing them as the problem, if only they would stop acting that way, I would feel better. It's an actual incredible opportunity to get in touch with what inside of us has been activated by their display. And so that's part of the non-locality of Watiko, in that it's showing up seemingly outside in the world, and at the same time it correlates to that same place inside of us that's being touched. And so it's actually an opportunity to add light to that shadow that's activated in us.
Right, I get that. But you also talk about it collectively. I saw the article you wrote about the Newtown killings as this manifestation of our collective illness. Can you talk about that in terms of the collective awareness?
Sure. Well, one way of understanding the thing about what we're talking about, the thing about Watiko is that it's a collective psychosis. So it will actually, it can take over at any given moment. Any one person becomes its conduit and its instrument to incarnate it in the world. And it also operates throughout the field, which is to say it can act out through a group of people or through a species. And that's what's actually happening in our world, in the form of that there's this psychic, like this epidemic or like this collective psychosis. And then what will happen, you see, when somebody's taken over by Watiko, they, in a way, can very easily tap into the archetypal, like this sort of a dimension of our experience that is not just the personal dimension, but is more like transpersonal. And they can access, there's a certain like charisma or power that then they can access, and they can have this real, like, this magnetism. And if people aren't awake, they can easily become sort of entranced by the other person's...
I mean, like Adolf Hitler or some other...
Exactly,
that kind of...
exactly. Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. And so then people begin to follow Hitler or Bush or whoever it would be, thinking that, oh no, they're just on the side of good and they're just these righteous people. And yet, unwittingly, they're being these non-local agents for this collective psychosis to actually propagate itself throughout the field. And so that's where with the evil of Watiko, yeah, it can operate through an individual person, but it can do its most damage when it brings people together, and then it'll entrance people through their unconscious blind spot, and then that gets reinforced when other people follow and support each other, and then an impenetrable, like this bubble, gets conjured up around the people, so any reflection of what they're doing, of the insanity of what they're doing, will get resisted, and the people who are the messengers will be seen as demons.
Right, but in terms of like the Newtown on that attack on the innocent children, I mean, of course it's an awful thing, and it is part of our reality and dream, but I don't know, to those children and to the reality that we think exists, how do we make sense of that?
Right, right. And the thing is, the article that I wrote, okay, so I'm here on the West Coast, and there was a shooting in the Portland, in this mall, a couple days before the Sandy Hook shooting. And
yes,
the day that the mall reopened was the day of the Sandy Hook shooting. So I make the point, wow, it's like I'm having a recurring dream. And then I began to wonder, what if we viewed what's happening as if it's a dream? And the thing about when you have dreams, they're speaking a language, and the language is not like this literal language, it's symbols. And so then you begin, or I began to wonder, wow, what is this dream? That's this recurring dream of just, you know, kids getting killed and people getting killed, and it's getting more and more amplified. What is it actually showing us about something in ourselves? And just that perspective alone all of a sudden opens up a whole deeper process of self-inquiry and of insight, okay?
What is it showing us, do you think?
Well, the thing is, on the one hand, you know, it's showing us that we're not seeing... So on the one hand, here is the killer, whether it was one person or people think, oh, there was some sort of multiple killers or, you know, all these inconsistencies. But think about the kids. Here the kids are just these innocent part of ourselves, as well as like even the teachers who were just protecting them and being these heroes. So here were these innocent parts of ourselves that were just being in cold blood, just murdered. And so it's something, and that's the recurring pattern that's happening again and again. So And it's easy to see the evil out there because we have all the evidence. Well, there it is. Here are the kids being killed. There's the killer out there. But yet, it's actually reflecting something, if it's seen as a dream, that's reflecting something really evil and dark in our own selves. And if we think of the killer as separate, then we're in the state of polarization, which is actually feeding the Wetiko bug, which will ensure that something like that happens even in more amplified form.
So if we see it as part of our collective culture, then there's something wrong with our collective culture. There's something that's not valuing innocence and harmony and
right, and that's the thing. You see, with interpreting a dream, I'm very hesitant to say, oh, well, here's the interpretation, because that's just one person's interpretation. It's not a one-size-fits-all process of interpreting dreams. But what you're pointing at is so right on, Alan, because, yeah, there is something the matter with our culture. Our culture, we as a species, are in the middle of a collective psychosis of titanic proportions, and hardly anybody is talking about it. And if you think about what we're doing to each other and to the biosphere, we're actually on a mass scale committing suicide. And hardly anybody is even talking about it because it seems like it's this normal state of affairs, which is itself an expression of how unbelievably insane we've all become.
And this is what Tiga, I mean, you've given it a name, and it's more, I mean, of course, I mean, yes, you say a lot about the name, but it's a state of consciousness itself. And
right, well, it operates through the channel of our consciousness. So like I was saying, it's like it informs, you know, our state of consciousness, our mind, and our perceptions in a way such that we compulsively act it out, but in a way that hides itself from being seen. Because, you see, when we see it, when we see Wetiko, it can't stand to be seen. Because when you see it, it can only operate through the darkness, through the unconscious. When we see it, when we give it, we find its right name, or we really, you know, see its footprints and understand how it works, then we take away any of its power over us, and then we access that power, and we become empowered.
Right, okay? But we haven't, I mean, it is like a recurring nightmare. Every time you turn on the television, there's another mass shooting somewhere, and every time you hear that, it's like, oh no, it is the same dream, and so we haven't got it yet. It's there, but we have, what is the answer to uncovering this thing?
Right. Well, the thing is, one of the things when you inquire into, like I try to do in the book, is what is the nature of Wetiko? And, you know, you begin to realize, wow, it actually can potentially, if we see what it's showing us, it could potentially help us to really expand our consciousness and to see, you know, the dreamlike nature of our situation, and to help us to actually wake up. And what I present is that there are more and more people who are actually having that experience. And so, yeah, it's very convincing to fall into despair and to think, oh my God, I have all the evidence I need that things are just really horrible and getting worse and all that. But, you know, to not forget that more and more people are waking up. And it's not just a question of like individual people waking up, but then when they connect with each other, through what they're realizing, and one way of understanding this that really helps is that if you're in a dream at night and you have lucidity, right? So you've recognized that you're dreaming, but all the other dream characters, they're aspects of you, and that's what you've recognized. If you have lucidity, well, then imagine, I'm invoking the imagination now, imagine what would happen when 2 or 10 or 100 or 1,000 of those dream characters in your dream, when they also have the recognition that they're dreaming. So they recognize the nature of their situation, and they connect with each other. They discover that they can put what they're realizing together, this under this expanded consciousness, in such a way to change the dream they're having, because that's what they're realizing, that the dream is nothing other than their own consciousness just appearing in the seemingly external way to themselves. And that's our situation. That's our situation in the waking dream.
Right, and I want to talk about that, but I also want to talk a little bit more about this negative projection, because if we see, like, the killing of these innocent people, we also have to see that the United States is doing these, drone attacks on people overseas, and they, I mean, we're involved in these wars and these invasions, and it's like what you say in the book, this projected shadow onto someone else coming back to us.
Yeah, totally. And the thing is that, you know, one of the things, you know, it's important to understand that where we all have sort of this, like, you know, in a way we're like have a complicity with what's actually playing out in our world. So, and that's really important to understand because that makes us part of the system that's actually perpetrating the evil. And but about the projection of the shadow, that's the psychological sort of engine that underlies Watiko. And just in the really simple way, the whole way that works is that if I split off from my own shadow and I'm not connected with it and I don't see it or own it, well, what's going to happen? It's going to get thrown outside of me. I'll project it onto someone else. Then they'll actually, you know, even more kind of incarnate the very shadow that I'm throwing on them. And as they more embody that darkness, then I have more evidence to prove, oh, that the evil is really outside of myself. So then I become even more entrenched in projecting it outside of them. And they're doing the same thing to me. And then we both have evidence that the evil exists outside of ourselves, and we try to kill each other. But by doing that, we actually become possessed by the very evil that we're trying to kill. And that whole process is a reflection of the actual impulse in our psyche to get rid of our darkness. That's actually what's playing out on the world stage. And
but
so we see it's all synchronistic.
How could you ever get rid of it? I mean, if you use your example, you look at like the war in the Middle East, the Israelis versus the Palestinians. You know, I've talked to both sides, and when you talk to them, they both seem right in their projection onto the other. And so
right.
There's
and one way of understanding that, Alan, is like, okay, just go back to the dream. If you hold a viewpoint in the dream, right? Now, what is a dream? But it's actually nothing external, but it's just a reflection of your own mind. So if I'm holding a viewpoint in a dream that somebody's a bad guy and they're evil and they're attacking me, well, being that what is a dream but my own, just like it's my own energy just reflected back, then, of course, they're gonna embody that and supply all the evidence I need to support me in my viewpoint. So then I get even more entrenched in the viewpoint. And then the more I project out the shadow, the more I actually invoke it in this feedback loop. And so that's how Watiko works. It works through the projective tendencies of the mind. And so I've actually done articles about the Middle East because the inner meaning, I talked about malignant, you know, sort of like the egophrenia, the ME disease. Well, one of the names of ME disease is Middle East disease because I talk about that it's like when you see the greater body politic, it's like there's this localized inflammation or outbreak of this non-local, higher-dimensional disease called Watiko in the Middle East. And if you want to understand what it is, just contemplate what's playing out in the Middle East, and you'll see Watiko in action.
Right, but there doesn't seem – these guys are not going to wake up and say, hey, you know what? I'm just projecting myself onto you. It seems like an ongoing eternal battle, unless maybe one conscious leader comes forward. But it doesn't seem like it's happening.
Right, and the thing is, I want to point out, and I totally get what you're saying. I mean, you have all the evidence to prove your opinion that you just shared. And at the same time, if we hold that viewpoint – of like just having this like, you know, sort of this pessimistic viewpoint, we're then actually feeding Watiko. But I mean, I totally get what you're saying. And at the same time, like one way of understanding this is that if you have a glass of water and dissolve these grains of like this sugar in the water, it will dissolve and dissolve and dissolve, and you reach the saturation point, you add one more grain of sugar, and a crystal will just spontaneously manifest. And what I'm pointing at is that any one of us at any moment having the realization of Watiko or the dreamlike nature or owning our shadow or self-reflecting might be that grain of sugar that precipitates an entire change in the collective unconscious.
Oh, so you're saying because it's always been this way and I see it in sort of this endless battle, I'm feeding that virus itself. But if I say, you know, it doesn't have to be that way, and what else do you suggest people do then?
Yeah, well, the thing is that, you know, one of the things that you learn when you really inquire into this whole topic is that it's through the individual. It's not through any sort of, like, political action. Yeah, it's important to try to be politically active as best we can, but any one of us really accessing the place in a way that's invulnerable to Watiko, which is the true nature part. That's in Tibetan Buddhism, they'll call it that. Or, you know, Jung calls it just the self. When we get in touch with that part of us, because as long as we're fighting Watiko, then it's already won. You know, we can't, if we fight evil, then we're unwittingly feeding it. And if we don't fight it in a way like, oh, there's nothing to do, we're unwittingly feeding it too. Like an example, if we think, oh, this thing called Watiko is a really real phenomena, well, then we've fallen under its spell. Because I pointed out, ultimately, it has no objective reality. But if we think, oh, it's not real, I don't need to put my attention on it, well, then guess what? We fed it even more because it works through our being in avoidance of it. But what I'm pointing out is that there's a third way of having to deal with Watiko, and that is getting in touch with the part of yourselves that's transcendent to and invulnerable to its evil effects. That's the self. That's the true nature. Any one of us doing that actually has a profound, you know, like this beneficial effect on the entire field.
Well, that's good because I'm starting to understand what you mean. And I was reading this, your book, and you go on and on about its manifestations and its effects. And I was thinking, is there any way out from this? And you're saying it's being the real self, but how do I know I'm not deluding myself into the real self? And it's a Watiko camouflage.
That's a beautiful question, because one of the ways of really, in a sense, having an inoculation against Watiko is to have the humbleness of having the realization that at any moment we're masters at self-deception, and we could be fooling ourselves. And so often, with the best of intentions, we do that. And so that's kind of why, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, for example, they'll talk about the Sangha, one of the three gems, the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the teacher, the teaching, and the community. And they'll talk about that. That's one of the foundations of awakening, is having an enlightened community. So when you have, you know, other people who are also awakening, who can play reflecting these mirrors for each other and help each other to stabilize their lucidity and keep themselves grounded and centered and not getting into a delusion or a deception, that really, really helps. So just that question I really appreciate, because, yeah, that's a perfect question.
Well, I think, what I get the sense is some of this recent writing comes out of the groups you've been doing and the communities, in a sense, that you've been creating. And they really sound fascinating, because each person in the group, from what I've heard, it's then becomes an experience for everybody else. So if someone is, you know, triggering someone, it can be seen as their unconscious made manifest in front of them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. And so I've had these groups for since the early, almost, I guess, 90, since 94, whatever. And I have them, you know, three or four nights a week in my house. And, you know, and they're people who are actually plugging in to that we're dreaming, that we're actually having a shared dream. And there's a way of hanging out with each other. There's a way of inquiring into the nature of our experience, where we actually can discover how we're actually dreaming and discover how we're creating our experience. And that changes people's entire scene. It's just a way of, instead of,
well,
oh, the fact
well,
that
give me an example of how, like an example, I mean, you don't have to name names, but something that happened where someone had that revelation of their dream being made manifest that shifted them.
Sure. Well, I'll give you an example. Say if somebody comes in, and this happens so often, somebody will come in and they'll be in a super activated process in their own psyche, but they decide, oh, I'm not going to talk about it because, no, I talk a lot every week and I'm just going to sit and see what happens. And all of a sudden, they're in the group and they're not saying anything, and all of a sudden, their very inner process will manifest in the group. People, without even knowing what's happening in that person's head, will start actually playing out their process, you know, or playing out that person's process, which is synchronistically also the other person's process, too. And if that happens in a real extreme way, the person who's sitting there in silence typically will say, oh, my God, I can't believe it. I came in here not wanting to talk. I wasn't going to really bring my process. And now the very process that's happening inside of my head is synchronistically unfolding in front of my very eyes through the group. And then they can actually engage with it and interact with it in a way that can actually help to unlock the energy that was bound up in the compulsion to recreate their wound becomes freed through the actual playing out of the process in a container. You see, in a container is an alchemical term, and that's what the groups are, a hermetic vessel.
Right, and then you can also take that kind of way of looking at things and talk about how the world every minute is reflecting our unconscious or maybe conscious process. I mean, I see it all the time.
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, you discover when you go into this that it's not like the psyche is inside of our heads, but we are inside the psyche. That's what I mean when I say that.
Explain what the psyche, I sort of get the sense of what you mean, but can you maybe define it a little more?
Sure. Well, like, you know, the one way of understanding the psyche is that it's both the unconscious and the conscious processes. And so, in a way, it's the source of, you know, any sort of not only thoughts or feelings that we're having, whether it's conscious or not, but also the thing about the psyche, it's this non-local phenomena. So it's not just operating, you know, inside of our brains or inside of us, but it also synchronistically, in a way, configures the seemingly outer world to express itself. And you see, that's when we see that, that's the point where actually we really have the expansion of consciousness and step out of imagining, oh my God, I'm separate from the world, because what you've just discovered is that, oh my God, my inner process is getting reflected and expressed via the world, that there must be some form of interconnection with me in here and the world out there. And all of a sudden, the separation between the two dissolves.
Right. I get that. And I get, okay, there's things that that I want in my life, and I don't have some things, and yet that's obviously reflecting a part of me that's still not able to connect with something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, the thing, you know, you see, the thing about this is that it's not hard at any given moment to have, like, the insight into this being a dream, in the same way that it's not hard in a night dream to have the recognition, oh, wow, I'm dreaming. But then it's so easy to get absorbed back into the forms of the dream and to forget we're dreaming. So part of it is that you develop, you know, part of, like, the way I understand doing any sort of, like, a spiritual practice is to really stabilize that understanding where it's not just intellectual at all. That doesn't help much at all. But you're really, everything that's happening, instead of being an obstacle, you know, and getting in the way of us having this realization, actually stimulates it. And, you know, to just greater and greater heights and depths, because we're getting in touch with who we are, which is this incredible light, you know, being, and who also has the deepest, darkest shadow imaginable, that we're a totality, and we're a whole. If we're a whole system, we include both the light and the dark.
So if the world is a manifestation of our psyche, then it's giving us everything we want to reflect who we are, but yet we're stuck in this process of wanting more. Is that the Wittico virus that is possessing us, or are we truly, as human beings, here to manifest our desires as well?
Right. Well, no, there's nothing that's intrinsically the matter with having desires, even though that can be one of the poisons that can obscure our true nature. But the thing about Wattico is that it's sort of like this energy, when it gets into us, it's kind of like the energy that just will inspire that craving or that always wanting more. It's like, oh, we feel a void or an emptiness, and we want to fill it. But we have, like, this insatiability. We can never quite fill it. So we're always grasping and always wanting more. And in the ultimate sense, it's that grasping which is the very source of the evil of Wattico. And that's really an expression of not being in touch with, you know, with who we are, that true nature part, which is a fullness, which is, you know, it's not a lack or a scarcity point of view, but it's something that's self-sustaining in and of itself. And that just cuts through that endless consumption and endless wanting and craving and more, which, think about it, that gets played out synchronistically in our consumer society. And that's a reflection of the inner process of Wattico, you know, as it operates inside the psyche.
Well, let me just say for those people just tuning in that Watego, we're talking about Watego, which is a book Paul Levy has written called Dispelling Watego, which is really the manifestation of what would I say, the thing that possesses us away from ourselves. Does that sound?
Yeah, yeah. And one way of really understanding that, the thing about the Watego spirit is that it's an archetypal energy, so it's not a personal energy, and you could even say it's this daimonic energy, and the word, the daimon, is actually the inner voice, or the guiding spirit, and it's related etymologically to the genius and genie, and one's calling and vocation, and hearing a voice. So the point is, what Watego is, it actually, being this daimonic energy, it can literally take over a person. So then the person becomes possessed by the energy of Watego, and they literally will be its incarnation in the third dimension. And then it will act out in a negative way because it's not recognized, because they've been unconsciously taken over. They will act it out in a self or other destructive way, which is demonic. Okay, but encoded in the word daimon is, like I said, the inner voice, the guiding spirit. And the point is that if you actually, you know, consciously plug into that energy, it can actually inform, because encoded in the daimonic is the creative spirit. It can inform the highest creativity, but only if we have the recognition of what's happening. And if we don't, then we get drafted into being its unwitting, unconscious instrument of destruction.
So whatever is bringing us down or in the way, making us angry, if we look at that, in that looking and seeing is the source of an awakening, you're saying.
Yeah, well, the thing about Watego, it feeds on our not seeing it. You see, it's a form of being blind. It's a psychic blindness that imagines that it's actually sighted. And not only that, it imagines in an arrogant way that it's more sighted than anybody else. So what that means is that, you know, not only does it, you know, like when I'm saying, it operates through the unconscious, but it means that when you actually turn your awareness onto its operations and see how it works, then it dissolves. It can't stand to be seen. It takes away its any sort of omnipotence or autonomy it has, just gets totally dispelled. And so, yeah, it feeds on our looking away from it. It feeds on, like when these spiritual people I know, they're, you know, they can be really good people, very well-intentioned, but they just are identified with the light. They don't want to give any attention to the darkness, and they don't realize by doing that, by being in avoidance of the darkness, they're feeding the darkness.
Right, by everything is love and light, they're actually avoiding the totality of the whole human being, and they're actually keeping themselves stuck in a kind of unenlightened place.
Exactly, exactly. Right, because the thing is, you know, there are like the polarities of people who just who want to go too into the darkness and become fascinated by it. That's not good. That feeds Watego. Then there are people who just are in avoidance of it. No, I don't want to look at it. I'm just all about love and light. That feeds Watego. But there's a third way in between the two. And the third way is to see Watego and then to choose. Oh, I don't want to place my awareness on it now. I see you. I'm going to place my awareness on creating the world I want to live in. That's the point of view that dispels Watego.
Right. But it's seeing it, because you use the example in the book, if you're wearing yellow glasses, you can't see things that are yellow. So it's the seeing of this, that because we're so used to our kind of engulfing personality and thinking that's how we are, how do you actually turn around and see what it is you're not?
Right, and that's where, and I so appreciate that question, because that's where the idea of to self-reflect comes in. Because, you know, there's all this evil. I mean, one way of understanding this, think about this like a dream. And in a dream, everything that's manifesting in this seemingly external dream is a reflection of what's happening in the psyche of the dreamer, which is us. So here, in this waking dream, there's all this evil that's playing out. And, you know, so many people are just focusing and putting their attention out there. And, you know, very, you know, there's really value to doing that, but if you're doing that at the expense of, at the same time, reflecting, wow, what's getting ignited in me? Because when you see evil out there, it's impossible to not have the similar energy actually set aflame in yourself, in the same way that when we see the unconscious in somebody else being unconscious, it activates our own unconscious. It's impossible not to, because it's non-local. The same thing with evil. When we see it out there, it activates the same energy in ourselves, and that's the opportunity to actually like add our consciousness and awareness to what inside of us has been triggered. If we're able to metabolize that, then we're not going to react, which is just going to be feeding, because anytime we react out of unconsciousness, that feeds Watiko, then we can actually, with consciousness, actually respond and be a really positive agent of change in the world.
Yeah, but when you say evil, it's strange that the word evil is live backwards, you know?
Yeah, totally. No, absolutely. And even the word, you know, and I talk about this in the book, even the mere mention of the word evil triggers people. Like, people don't even want to hear about it or think about it or read it.
It does. I was just going to react to it myself by saying, what do you mean by evil? What's evil, you know?
Right, right. Some people say, oh, evil, there's no such thing as evil, or, you know, whatever. And so it's interesting. Everybody, just that's an example of Watiko. Just like here you even mention, it's like a mantra. You mention this word and it invokes this enormous response in everyone.
What is evil, or if it's just this possession by this kind of mindless thought form, then maybe that's all evil is. It's not real in a sense. It's just the action of this self-indulgent downward spiral.
Yeah, well, you know, the question, Alan, the question you're asking, like when you say, what is evil? I mean, that's not an easy question to answer. And I really, you know, the whole book is basically about that. And, you know, I really inquire into what is the nature of evil and what is its origin. And one thing I discover is that, you know, there's something called, a phrase, the coincidentia oppositorum, the coincidence of opposites. And more as you inquire into Watiko and you inquire into its incredible, this like archetypal evil that's encoded in Watiko, you actually discover, oh my God, at the same time, it's helping me to wake up. And then the question becomes, oh my God, is it really evil or is it really good? Or is there a difference? Or have the opposites been co-joined? And you see, that's the point of view of the self, when you actually recognize that the opposites are not opposite, but they're actually interdependent and interconnected and indistinguishable. That's the point of view of the self, and that's when you're in touch with your own wholeness.
Oh, I okay? see. So if anyone who has an obstacle or something, you know, I'm always putting up with my resistance to do what, you know, different jobs and different projects I'm on. I mean, there's things I want to do, but I have a resistance to doing it. And that seems like it's the Watiko that has taken hold of me, the resistance. And you talk about that, but I notice it, but then getting through it is I don't know the direct path through that.
Yeah, and one of the ways, and I talk about this in the book, is, you know, when in that moment when you're feeling the resistance or feeling stuck or feeling the obstacle, right? Now, just go back to the dream. If you see that moment as having a reality, oh, wow, this is, you know, the fact that I'm feeling really my wound or my trauma or my stuckness or resistance, now I have all the evidence that I really am, you know, that I really have a problem. And so then you hold that viewpoint, right? Well, think about it. Your experience is a reflection of your viewpoint being like a dream. So as soon as you hold that point of view, then instantaneously it will shapeshift and reflect back the truth of your viewpoint, i.e. that you really have a problem. And then you're complicit in your own, you know, being stuck. But the antidote to that is, in that moment when you're feeling that resistance or that stuckness, is to have the recognition, oh my God, this is the actual, instead of being an obscuration to my enlightenment, this is the expression of my enlightenment. This is the form my enlightenment is taking at this very moment. I can embrace what's happening. I don't have to invest it with an unwarranted sort of like actual having a reality or a solidity. And I can just be spacious around it. And then when you hold that viewpoint, what happened to the resistance? It has no place to stand. It just will naturally just dissolve back into the emptiness out of which it arose.
So in a way, if I use that, then the resistance is sort of the friction, and me being aware that is the pushing against well, it's the thought form, but pushing against that to keep myself going in a way. Noticing it is actually the impulse to move beyond it.
Yeah, and that just points to that, you know, the thing about Watiko, it has these multiple channels of manifestation, whether it's being, you know, our resistance or, you know, feeling like wounded or I'm in trauma or just, you know, anything where we feel like we're suboptimal as far as, like, we all have these incredible, these gifts. You see, the thing about Watiko, who we are these like, actual, you know, kind of like these creative, like, a genius, and yet Watiko will plug into our genius for how we create reality, such that we create it in a way that we become really this limited being. And what your question is pointing at is the profound importance of just having that noticing or that awareness on what's actually presenting itself in the moment. And that's the thing, when we develop and really cultivate that sense of having that mindfulness and having that awareness, then that's in the service of really dispelling Watiko. And that's why towards the end of the book I talk about the profound importance of finding the name. Because in any sort of mythology or a fairy tale, whenever there's a demon, which is a way of describing what Watiko is that when you find the proper name, the right name of the demon, it takes away its power. Okay, and that's why, you know, the indigenous people, this was their word for this exact, you know, energetic, this spirit, you know, so it really can help to have the right name, to have that right, it's the power of the word, basically.
Well, by just calling it whatever it is, by telling the truth of what it is. But the other thing that came up as you were saying it, it's my relationship to this thing, this Watiko, because I don't just feel the resistance. I feel who I am in relationship to the resistance. So if I was not if I didn't have the sense of the purity of the self, I wouldn't feel the relationship to this other.
Right, you know right. I mean? And you discover that the problem isn't necessarily the seeming like the negative like energy of the resistance or whether it's like some sort of demon. That's not ultimately problematic. The seeming problem is, what do we do relative to that energy? What is our relationship to it? That's the place of where that's like sort of the point of like leverage, where we can actually add our awareness and really then have that actual manifestation of, you know, the resistance or the obstacle actually help to stimulate us to even greater heights of lucidity. You see, and that's to be an alchemist, because that's to transmute. You see, encoded in that energy of that resistance or Watiko or evil, encoded in that is the energy for awakening. And it's all a question of, are we going to have the recognition of that and be able to alchemically like plug into that and transmute that energy to serve, you know, our creative, our just expression.
So it's the obstacle that gives us the energy and the awareness to, in a way, to formulate the self, to light the way, to show the darkness. If there was no darkness there, we wouldn't have to awaken the light to show.
Right,
to
and that's
it.
Why one of the main things I talk about is that the manifestation of the darkness is, it's both an absence of light, and at the same time, when you have a deep dark shadow, it's an expression of the presence of light being really right nearby. So the point is that the light actually shows itself through the darkness, okay? So then all of a sudden you've recontextualized what darkness really is, instead of seeing it as something bad to get rid of or to avoid, or it's in opposition to light. No, you begin to realize it's an actual expression of, in a way, of a higher dimensional form of light, you know, of the light of sentient awareness itself, okay? And that's then getting into that whole point of the opposites become more and more co-joined, where, you know, the light and dark, you realize, oh my God, they're actually indistinguishable, because they're, you can't separate them out.
Well, like as far as like Newton, if we didn't have a sense of what innocence and purity was, if we didn't have that awareness in us, we wouldn't be so, it wouldn't be so awful, you know, but because we know that, I mean, it's not exactly what you're saying, but it just kind of...
Yeah, no, that's helpful. But one other image that comes up, like one of my teachers once said to me, he goes, yeah, you know, if you have a seed and you put the seed in your hand, it's not going to grow. But if you take that same seed and put it under the earth, under the soil, where there's like resistance, all of a sudden, because of that resistance, it starts to sprout and can grow into a tree. Okay? And that's one way of understanding that sometimes having resistance can actually really be in service of something really good.
Right. Right. And but, you know, it seems like the 20th century was an awful, I mean, it was century, it, you know, for war and destruction and let's call it evil. And yet we had these great advancements. But isn't it time we somehow collectively overcame the shadow that seems to be still occupying our world?
I know. Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm in full agreement with that. And that's one way of really sort of having a deeper view of what Watiko is, that Watiko, you know, like one way of understanding this is unlike Christ, you know, when he incarnated and it was like a light from above came down, you know, to our planet, what's happening now is that here's God, who instead of coming down from heaven is coming up from the underworld in the form of the dark, in the form of Watiko. And it's actually, you see, just to sort of say a little bit more about this, and I talk about this in the book, whereas with Christ, God incarnated through one human being, but he was just totally an instrument for the light. And then when you see this dream, then there's Satan who is embodying and carrying all the dark because the opposites were totally polarized. But in current day, all of our species, all of, you know, the whole, all of humanity are the vehicles for the incarnation of God. So God is incarnating not just through one human being, but through all of us. But unlike Christ, we are tainted with darkness. We have a shadow. And so the closer that God is coming to incarnating through us, we have to come to terms with that evil, that with that shadow that we actually partake of, that none of us is without. And that's manifesting from the dream point of view as the Watiko epidemic, as the incredible destruction that we're enacting on each other and on the planet and on the biosphere. And the point is that that's the revelation of the divine, and it's actually showing us something. And one of the things it's showing us is that we're dreaming. We're actually having a Masher dream. And when you see that, like I've been saying before, you actually begin to wake up. And that's why I'm pointing out that encoded, hidden in the venom of Watiko is some form of a blessing. But it only will manifest. It's very quantum. Like, is light a wave or a particle? It depends how you observe it. Same thing with Watiko. Will it destroy our species or will it wake us up? Well, it depends. How are we going to dream it? Do we recognize what it's revealing to us?
It depends how conscious we are. If we are conscious of what's in our way or what's collectively in our way, if we can become conscious of and aware of the... Yeah, I get that. And then you talk in the real last part of the book about the creative imagination really being the engines for driving evolution.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because being like a dream, you know, the source, the foundation of our experience, moment by moment, of ourselves is the creative imagination. But it's not just the personal creative imagination. It's the part of our imagination that interfaces with the imagination of the divine. When you study alchemy, this is exactly what alchemy, this is the whole fundamental, like, root of what the whole alchemy was about, is tapping into the imagination of God. And so we ourselves all have that in you know, in our psyches, in ourselves. And so depending on how we actually interpret our experience and place meaning in our experience and imagine into our experience, we're actually creating moment by moment our experience of ourselves and of the world. And so it's a very, it's like we're these artists. It's like we're these creative artists, these multidimensional creative artists, and whose canvas is this world. And how are we going to dream it? How are we going to create? What world are we going to create? There's no one outside of ourselves who's doing that for us. We ourselves are the dreamer of the dream.
I mean, the more I talk to you and the more I read your book, the more I sense that that really is a reality for you, that you really do live as if everything is a dream around you, and you seem pretty happy about it, I think, you know?
Yeah, well, no, that's definitely true, and I'm living in a dream where, like, our, you know, all the rest of my fellow brothers and sisters, we're in this deeper process of destroying ourselves, and that really concerns me, because that's not separate from me. That's like, you know, a reflection of some part of me. You see, because the energetic expression of when you realize the dreamlike nature is compassion, you know, and that just cuts through the whole duality of separation. You realize, oh my God, we're actually characters in each other's dreams. We're actually interconnected and interdependent, and there's a way of us, and we do this in these groups that, you know, I was talking about before, of coming together such that, I've coined a phrase, we can conspire to co-inspire, right? So it's like this real conspiracy theory. We can conspire to co-inspire, to activate the genius, the collective genius in the field that's greater than the sum of its parts. And so, yeah, I began having this experience a long time ago of, oh my God, this is like a dream. And I've been fortunate in being able to just continue to deepen and stabilize that realization. And, you know, it's exactly what any wisdom tradition ever in all of history, doesn't make a difference which one, they're all articulating exactly this realization in their own way.
Right, right. And I know, Paul, it hasn't been easy for you. I know in your first book you go through, and if you want to say a little bit about your personal history, because it's not like you just woke up or you lived that way your whole life. You really worked to come to this understanding, and it's pretty amazing.
It was unbelievable. It was an unbelievable ordeal, and I'm still a work in progress. I mean, I'm still continually, you know, deepening my compassion and my realization and integrating, you know, my shadow. But what happened for me, I'm an only child, and I wound up, my father was really a sick man, and he was undiagnosed, and he acted out his, you know, his abuse and his shadow onto me, and it created enormous suffering on me, or in me, and I went into it. I just, instead of going around the suffering, I realized, oh my God, I really have to kind of, you know, come to terms with this. And I went inwards and had a profound awakening after a couple of years of doing intense meditation. And that was when all of a sudden stuff began happening in my life that could only happen in dreams, that were totally out of the ordinary, that weren't supposed to be able to happen in this particular third dimension. And they were happening on like this regular basis. So during, this was 1981, during that first year, I got thrown in mental hospitals a number of times and told, oh, you're mentally ill, you've gone insane, you'll have this illness for the rest of your life, you're going to have to be on medication until your last breath. And I would just reflect back to them, God, you have no idea what you're talking about. You know, you're out of your mind, you know, and they didn't understand at all, because it was so long ago, about spiritual awakening. So the fact that I was disagreeing with them was more proof to them of my insanity. And so in a way, you know, as I got more and more embedded or entangled in the psychiatric community, the sicker I got, and they began medicating me and diagnosing me, and my parents totally bought into the diagnosis because, you know, in their world, you know, psychiatrists are authority figures. And, you know, the tragedy, so I quickly got out of that whole situation, but it was, it almost killed me, and it almost drove me totally crazy. It was so traumatic and so abusive, and the tragic aspect is that both of my parents died completely convinced that their only child is mentally ill. So I've just had to deal with that. So I don't have any family left, because all the rest of my relatives, I've kind of been excommunicated or banished from the family. And because I was the one who was shedding light on the abuse, on the evil that was getting played out in the family system, and I didn't understand, oh, wow, that's an unpopular, you know, sort of voice to pick up. But it also was the very thing that introduced me to the non-local field, because the more I was shedding light on the evil that was playing out in my family and then in psychiatry, I was realizing, oh, my God, the field is configuring itself to protect the darkness. And that was my introduction to, wow, there's actually a higher dimensional non-local field that informs what's actually happening in the world.
So, you know, thanks for that. And do you want to just share some of the amazing dreamlike experiences that you had, just so people...
Sure. I mean, I'll share one. You know, there were so many, and typically, you know, it's very clear not to really talk about them.
No, just you one know. Is fine. Yeah.
Just sure. One. So I'll just tell, because I've spoken about this so many other times. And it was the, you know, so I was sitting in meditation, and I got, this is in the spring of 1981, and I got hit by a bolt of lightning, but not from the sky, but just in my own mind, it just in my brain, it just ignited for a second. And then within 24 hours, I went into this incredible, like, altered state in which I was recognizing for the first time in my life, oh, my God, we're having a dream. This is a mass shared dream. Mm. And I was in this ecstatic state. And so it was like I had stepped out of my normal sort of, you know, kind of conditioned identity pattern. And, excuse me, and then I had a friend who was visiting me. I was living out in the Bay Area, and he was visiting me, and I was acting so strange, where unlike my normal self, that he brought me by ambulance to a hospital, to Highland Hospital in Oakland, California. This is, I guess it was in May of 1981, and they bring me into the psychiatric ward, and the very first room they bring me into, where all the psych patients are, it's at night, and I see this woman, and she's blind. And her eyes are totally opaque with no radiance. It's just clear she can't see. And I just, without even thinking, I just feel totally drawn, and I go right up to her. And I get really close, and I'm staring at her eyes, and I just start saying the words. It was like I was given a script to say just spontaneously. It was like I was almost like a channel for these words. And I began saying to her, as I'm staring at her eyes, I'm just saying, all you have to do to see is open your eyes and look. And I kept on saying those words over and over, all the while I was looking at her eyes, getting closer and closer to her. The whole thing took not even a minute, and she regained her sight. And
wow.
Then, as if it was choreographed, you know, the doctors or the nurses or whatever came, and they took me and they strapped me up on a bed in another room, and that's where I spent the night. And I knew I was having a spiritual awakening. I mean, you know, I was contemplating what had just happened. Well, to complete the story, the next morning they unstrapped me, and they put me in a room, and I'm sitting at a table, and who's the only other person in the room but this woman who's now seeing? And she's just staring at me, but smiling ear to ear, you know, just sort of, you know, really big grin on her face. And all of a sudden, my heart chakra just blossomed, and it opened, and I realized, oh, I get it. Her eyes were physically fine, but psychically, she wasn't letting herself look, and that was manifesting as her blindness, and she was ready to heal, and I was the one who was sent, you know, in to pick up my role and to play, you know, to say my lines, and it was as if I had prepared for lifetimes for that very moment, and that was, and I, you know, had this insight, oh, and I was just playing a role in a deeper dreaming process between us. And then she says to me the only words that she ever said to me. She said, aren't you going to answer the phone call? And she mentions my father's name. And within 10 seconds or 5 seconds into the room walks a nurse and says, Paul, your father's on the phone. Because my parents had just found out that I had been locked up in a mental hospital and supposedly had a psychotic break. And so that was really the start of my career. Because so I got out of that hospital after 3 days because I had to convince the doctor I wasn't crazy. So I just forced myself down and became totally normal and, you know, was talking about my problems and he let me out. And we got together, the doctor and I, you know, the next week for lunch. And I told him what had happened with the blind woman, but he was very uncomfortable and couldn't talk about it. You know, he mentioned patient confidentiality. So that's an example. But then I was so, you know, excited, I began telling all my friends about what had happened, which was just more proof to them of how crazy I was, because I didn't understand, oh, wow, you don't cast your pearl before a swine type of thing. You need experiences like that. Not everybody can really, like, relate to that.
Right, but you had a mystical awakening. It sounds like it was like a kundalini going through you, and you were accessing this higher realm of consciousness for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it was definitely kundalini. There was such kundalini coming through me that it was, I mean, I'm amazed I didn't spontaneously combust. It was that type of thing.
And so that woke you up. I mean, it seems to this, the nature of reality being a dream. I mean, because
well, that was the start. I mean, that was just the first of many, many experiences. And, but yeah, that definitely, I mean, from that moment on, I was living in a different universe. That was like, you know, I was never to return to the ordinary, you know, to the life I had been living, for sure.
Right, because it wasn't real. I mean, you can see it was not where you were.
Yeah, no, totally. It was like I had pierced through some sort of like a veil, and it was almost like there was a parallel, this world right over here, right next to the world that most of us live in, and somehow I had stepped into it. And then it was just a question of, was I going to be able to really, you know, to sort of, to be able to assimilate what I was being shown. And it's taken me over 30 years, and I'm still in the process of unpacking and integrating what's being shown to me. You know, I'm not in any way a finished product.
Well, I know, because what's being shown to you is, in a way, being shown to all of us.
Exactly. Totally.
I mean, it's a revelation. It's not, it hasn't, it's, it keeps uncovering itself. I mean,
yeah, no, exactly. That's exactly it. And that's, you know, even the word, you know, people say, oh, these are like these apocalyptic times. Well, the apocalypse, as far as the etymology of the word, is something hidden that's being shown to us. You know, so one thing that's being shown to us is, oh, we're having a dream. And one other thing that's being shown to us is the darkness, not just the personal darkness, but the transpersonal archetypal darkness that we all partake in, including God. Mm. And, you know, but once we actually shed light on that stuff, it becomes more integrated into our wholeness.
Well, you know what might explain some of what we're talking about here is that little section that I thought was really great on symbols and symbolism, and the nature of the world is really symbolic. I mean, when you meet someone out there, I often think of that, well, this person reminds me of my mother, but they remind me of this other person I know, and this girl, and this, and this. And there's layers and layers of our projected symbols onto the world, the archetypal feminine. I mean, so it's how we relate to the symbols of the world that start to form our reality.
Yeah, and the thing is, I mean, it's important to understand what exactly is a symbol. And I go into that in the book, because it's different when you have, like, you know, just a sign. A sign you can understand in, like, this really, like, this literal way, like, one way, do not enter, is a sign. It's very easy to understand exactly what it means, but a symbol is actually an emanation of and pointing and reflecting something that's beyond itself and beyond ourselves. And you know, and the symbols is the language of dreams. You know,
right.
Now the thing to also understand about symbols is that they don't exist objectively, separate from us, in that we actually kind of have a transaction with the seemingly outer universe, and the actual fruit of that transaction between us and what seems to be outside of ourselves is a symbol. That's the actual interchange of that dynamic, and so it's tailor-suited to us, to our unconscious. It's actually speaking to our unconscious. And if we actually, you know, are able to sort of uncover what the symbol is pointing at, or decode it, or in any way get into phase with it, it will actually unlock the very energy out of which the symbol is an expression of. So it
can
really transform.
So if we have
really
a situation in our lives, then that situation, whatever it is a symbol of something to unlock within the sort of awakening of our soul's evolution, let's put it that way.
Yeah, totally. And then you begin to realize, oh, that's a way of seeing, like, every moment of what's happening in our life, is to see it symbolically. That's really the point. You see, that perspective, that's to see the dreamlike nature, and that perspective really dispels the toxicity of Watiko. And so I'm saying, yeah, it's one thing when one person establishes themselves in that point of view, but then when more and more people actually are really kind of, you know, tapping into that and connecting with each other, like I was saying before, then they can actually put their realization together in a way to change the dream they're having, to change the waking dream. And that's evolutionary. And that's what we're being offered to participate in, is our own evolution. And that's what the Watiko epidemic is about. It's actually showing us exactly that.
So to change our personal dream, if there's things I want and desire, and well, I look at what's in the way as a kind of a shadow to shine the light on. Would you say that in a personal dream?
Yeah, sure. No, that's one way of understanding it. But also, as soon as you said that, Alan, I had the image of, like, so many of us, we have our personal process where we have, stuck places or obstacles. And, you know, understandably, we try to illumine that and do work on ourselves. But part of the problem is we identify ourselves as being a person. We personalize our process, or, you know, we identify with our process as, well, I'm really screwed up and this is my stuff. And all of that's true on one level, but there's a way of in a way, bringing in a deeper context in that we're like these shamans, and any of us are like oracles for the whole field. So we might be, through our personal, like, microcosm of who we are, of our person, we might be actually reflecting or expressing some sort of stuckness or illness that's in the macrocosm, that's in the entire field. And that it's,
well, even in our family's field, if you look at family constellation work, we take on the field of our local families.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm talking not just about family systems, but I'm talking about, what if you see the whole human family? And that, so any of us, all of a sudden, you know, we can snap out of personalizing our experience and thinking, oh, I'm just screwed up. But also, how about, wait a second, I'm feeling this, like, obscuring energy because this is the energy that pervades the entire non-local field of our species. Then all of a sudden, you know, you have a whole different point of view, which is way more spacious because you're not identifying with a very, like, personalistic, reductive point of view.
But still, how do you get through if someone's depressed or unhappy or this or that? I mean, if that represents the collective field of people or a lot of people, then the realization of it is one thing, that it's not yours, but then how do you
I understand that, and you ask such great questions, because one of the mistakes a lot of people make is they go around the personal to try to, I don't want to have to deal with that. I want to go right to the archetypal and see how my process is a reflection of the macrocosm.
And but they avoid. Avoidance. They're avoiding their own stuff.
That's avoidance, right, because the way to get to the archetypal is by fully going into the personal as much as you're able. That's the portal to really access the transpersonal or the archetypal, okay?
So by going into your, they say by allowing yourself to feel what you're feeling and have it go through you, there's a way of owning that experience and transcending it.
Yeah, no, totally. So you have to really, you know, have the willingness and the ego strength to be able to have relationship with these deeper archetypal energies and to experience whether you're, you know, oh, wow, there's a part of me that's traumatized or wounded or depressed. Yeah, you have to develop the capability to develop, like, having the space in your own self to be able to feel that. And that's different than just having the idea of it or thinking it. It's not an intellectual exercise, but to experience it through the feeling body, but then to allow it to self-liberate, to not identify with it. You know, that's the way through.
So that's some of the ways to work with your book. How else would you suggest people, you know, reading this book, The Spelling Wetiko, can work with the material you present?
Yeah, well, okay, the thing to realize about this book is that it's about, so I was talking about my awakening in 81, and so this book is really took me 30 years to write. I mean, this is sort of a compendium of because I've been writing for a long time, and this is like a collection of the best of my writing, where anything that could, because I was in such deep suffering having to do with the abuse with my father, anything that ever spoke to anything having anything to do with how to alleviate my own suffering, I would really study. And what this book is really, because I'm an artist, is like this creative kind of synthesizing of all of these different wisdom traditions, whether it's alchemy or being, you know, like sort of the shamanic tradition or right. mystical Christianity or Tibetan Buddhism or quantum physics, Jung's, you know, great work in psychology. It's all of those things, and they all complement each other and shed light on each other. And so it's really my creative attempt at actually creating a map and articulating how does evil work in the world and in ourselves in such a way that when you really see the map, and I'm inviting the reader to help to extend the map, it's a real collaborative effort, that it creates a net to catch, in a way, that shadow, such that instead of then it operating through us and we unwittingly becoming its instrument, we actually then are accessing that energy. Because one of the main things I talk about in the book is the profound importance of us connecting with being artists and expressing ourselves creatively, that when we do that, that really dispels the toxic effects of Watiko.
Right. I mean, in a way, the book is like an exorcism, because you are naming it and pointing the light on it and expelling it from the system of the collective unconscious, unawareness, and you're making it known. So
Totally. And I really appreciate you saying that, because, and I talk about it, even in the introduction, I had this particular dream where I was with like this Dracula figure, and I was, right, you know, doing in a way an exorcism on him in the dream, or he was going to kill me, and you know, and that's in a way what the book is about. Because one other thing, and I tell this dream too in the intro, that I had this incredible dream a number of years ago, right the morning that two of my teachers from Tibet were coming to visit me. And the dream was that everybody in the dream was trying to find this vampiric figure, and we were all looking for him. And then I see Dracula. It was Dracula. And then we're all chanting, Bela Lugosi, Bela Lugosi, as we're trying to find him. And I see him, and I try pointing him out to other people in the dream, and no one else could see him except for me. So one way of understanding, you know, what the book is that dream, but just extended over time as my life, in the sense that I've developed way more of a creative fluency and an ability to articulate and point out the vampire in a way that other people could see it. Because one way of understanding Watiko, it is a total vampire. And and then as we shed light on it, it you know, it has no power. And we
so in a way
empowered.
You were living your dream, the dream that you were dreaming, you started to live it. I mean, you did.
That's
live
exactly
it.
That's exactly it. Right. No, I appreciate you saying that. And so from that point of view, it's a total exorcism in the book, in the sense that I'm literally calling out, I'm invoking evil. And yet by doing that, I'm simultaneously invoking the light, or it would just kill me. And thankfully, I've been able to do that, because instead of the creative, you know, the writing of the book being something that was, you know, difficult for me, no, it actually helped me to unbelievably heal and integrate. And so it was really in the service of my own, you know, kind of more connecting with who I am.
I know North Atlantic gave you a little inspiration. Press gave you a little inspiration to keep going, because you published a shorter version of the book, and then you.
Right. No, that was great. I published a shorter version, and the plan was, because I knew, and I even wrote when I wrote the articles, I said that this is the most important stuff I have ever written in my entire life, you know. And then I took, you know, there were three articles. I wrote an intro. That was the original book, and my plan was to send it out to all these publishers with cover letters, you know, and seeing if they wanted to publish it. I didn't even have to do anything. Within weeks of the book coming out, the head of, like, the whole...
Is that Richard Grossinger?
Richard Grossinger.
He's
got in touch
with
me.
He's been on my show, yes. He's a good guy.
He got in touch with me, and he said, oh, we came across your book. We would love to republish it. And so we signed a contract, and then I had 5 months to get them the manuscript, and I could have just given them the same manuscript, but I felt, what an incredible opportunity. So every day I would go to the cafe I go to in the morning and get my, you know, my Americano, and I would literally spend 3-4 hours every single day, didn't miss one day for those 5 months, and I rewrote the whole book to the point where it's four times as much material, and it's in a way become, you know, I really have a sense, oh my God, this book is why I'm here on the planet, is to have, like, written this book.
Mm. Well, part of the writing of the book is actually the exposing of the beast itself, and I think waking us up to some new reality, some new level of who we are. You know.
Yeah. No, I really appreciate that, because that's exactly my, you know, what my point of view is. It's really just like flooding light on the nature of the beast, And having the recognition, well, this beast is not separate from us, and it's actually showing us something about ourselves. And so I'm just excited because it just came out, like, you know, on the 15th, and people are, you know, ordering it and first beginning to, you know, to go through the book. And all I want is for people just to read the book. That's, I feel, you know, sometimes as an artist, you make something and you feel really satisfied. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel that with this book. I feel like, wow, I really caught something that I feel can really be a benefit for people.
Well, it's not an easy book because it makes you feel a little uncomfortable, you know, which is a good thing, I think, because...
Yeah, well, absolutely. It's going to challenge you out of your comfort zone. Yeah. Definitely. You know, it's going to force you to look and self-reflect and see your own assumptions, if you have, like, beliefs that are in any way keeping you in this limited state. It's going to really challenge that, and a lot of people don't want to see that, because one of the things about Watiko, when I talk about this, is that encoded in the Watiko syndrome is a counter-incentive to experience itself. And what I mean is that we're all like it, having like sort of like the complicity with the evil that's playing out in the world, being that this is a mass shared dream. And for us to really become an agent of you know, sort of being able to be of benefit, we have to see the part of ourselves that's having the collusion with the evil. And to do that absolutely will involve, it's shocking, it's shattering, it induces a form of PTSD, of trauma. And so we have to have the willingness to, okay, I'm going to experience that. Like an example being if people are like supporting our government and thinking, oh, our government is for, and then you realize, oh my God, it's the government who's supposed to be protecting us, which is the very institution that I need protection from. That's right. A shattering realization, you know,
right.
And that,
like,
that's what I'm talking about.
Just like the medical field kills more people than probably any other illness in the country, and how education is in the way of people learning, religions in the way of spirituality. All these old institutions have gotten frozen to their purpose.
Right. And so you actually, it's sort of like being, it's very much, you know, similar to being in a cult and being a member of a cult and having the courage and the strength to be able to reflect and realize, oh my God, I've been taken for all I'm worth. I've been out of my mind. I've been besides myself, however you want to describe it. And to have the courage to really be able to have that realization and then to act on it and to snap out of that spell, that's what's involved in all of us, like, healing from the Watiko disease.
Well, yeah, and the scary part about reading the book is that you can see the Watiko inside yourself. I mean, you see
That's the deeper point, is that if we think, oh, you know, he has Watiko and we don't, that point of view, you've fallen under its spell. Then you have Watiko as much as anybody, if that's your perspective. The idea is that, no, it's non-local. So that, okay, it's playing out there, and any of us can be, you know, its instrument, but particularly ourselves, and to really shed light on how it operates in our own. Because if you think about it, it's actually informing and actually the inspiration for any sort of an addictive behavior. That's, in a way, Watiko.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's non-local in the sense that we're non-local and we're actually all aspects of the greater mind anyway. To think that the Watiko, in a sense, I mean, there's levels of it, gives us the illusion that we are these individual ego creations anyway.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. And that's why, you know, when I talk about, like, one of the names for, you know, egophrenia, for, like, malignant egophrenia is ME disease, me disease. Right. It's a misidentification of who we think we are. And that's totally inspired by Watiko. And as long as we hold that particular, like, identity pattern of feeling we're an isolated, egoic, skin-encapsulated self, then we're actually feeding Watiko simultaneously. So it's being inspired by Watiko at that point, and if we hold that point of view, it's actually investing in Watiko.
Right. So, concluding, we can see, I mean, there's so much to your work that, because you really live, the world is a dream. The world is your dream, and it's your dream creation, and your dreams are reflecting the unconscious that's still inside of us, and also the good things too. I mean, there's a lot of beauty and joy in the world, and that's part of the dream as well.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And part of my dream is that I've dreamed up this book that's kind of like my offering, you know, to the world. And, you know, I just am so excited for people to really check it out. And but you're totally right. I mean, to the extent, I mean, you know, I do practice every day, hours of spiritual practice. And one way of really, you know, articulating what I do is try to really establish myself in that point of view of every moment of experiencing whatever is happening in, you know, in my life is part of my dream. And I'm actually, you know, as the dreamer, so I'm simultaneously part of the dream, that a deeper dreaming self, that's what I call it, is having a dream, and I'm that dream, like all of us are the dream of that deeper self, while simultaneously I'm also the dreamer. And what I'm pointing at is that as more and more of us, you know, get tuned into that realization, we can connect with each other and activate what I call the sacred power of dreaming and change the waking dream we're having. And that's not just some sort of woo-woo, new-agey philosophy. That's what's actually offered to us. And that's total, like, that's this evolutionary sort of an experience where, in a way, this, you could say God is becoming awakened to him or herself through us, that we actually, and this is alchemy, that we play a crucial role in the divine incarnation process, and particularly when we come together and put our realization together, we can really make a difference and change the dream, and that's ultimately what my work is about.
That's great. That's what I'd love for you to do in New York at some point, if you come over here. Just,
sure,
I mean, just
yeah, no, I'm open. Yeah.
About that, because I think you investigate the nature of the psyche in ways that the mainstream really hasn't looked at, because they haven't integrated a spiritual awareness into what's been understanding of who we are as psychological or beings with a psyche. So
yeah, no, I feel that too. I mean, there's kind of a phrase, Jung has a phrase, he says, yeah, with modern behaviorist psychology, they've created a psychology without a psyche.
Right.
You know,
that's the problem. So,
yeah.
So I'm working with the ASP Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy, and I put together a kind of a manifesto about revisioning. Of course, James Hillman talked about revisioning psychology in terms of a spiritually based awareness that includes all these things, as like the inner voice and channeling and near-death experiences. So we need to expand the paradigm of what we know the psyche to be if we're going to create a new world that includes the kind of things and awarenesses that you're talking about.
Yeah, no, I so appreciate the work you're doing, Alan. I mean, that's so profoundly important, and that's what you're doing is what needs to happen, because our, you know, we have this really, this limited point of view about who we are and the nature of the psyche and psychology and the nature of spirituality that is killing us.
Right. It's in a box. It's in the box of limited possibilities, and we want to break out of the box into untold possibilities.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And that's what the artist is all about. I'm writing a lot about the artist's role in creating new realities, in a sense, because it's the artist that can cognize new patterns of perception that allow other people to recognize what the artist has cognized.
Yeah, and that's why, and I talk about that in the book, and that's one of the reasons why I talk about it's the figure of the artist who's actually going to heal the world.
Right. Yes, it is, because it's the artist in all of us. We all are the creative geniuses, and that was the real reason for our incarnating here, I'm sure it was.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's totally, and I talk about that all throughout the book.
Yeah, no, and yeah, and I, and especially in the last part you talk about, and this way you really kind of after you've kind of given us a kind of big overview of how we are possessed by the demonic forces, then all this hope, but then there is the hope of this creative imagination and being ourselves and coming into the wholeness of who we know ourselves to be, that really brings us into a new level of reality and to really why we're here.
Yeah, no, that's, I couldn't have said it better myself. That's exactly it. And that's where, like, you know, it's really important to not get kind of in, you know, sort of under the spell of like feeling despair and pessimism. Because if we do fall into that, then unwittingly we become an agent for Watiko, because then we will actually draw the evidence to confirm our pessimistic point of view. So what I'm saying is, yeah, things, you know, are happening and it's really very disturbing and very dark in a certain way. And there's a way of really holding a perspective where you actually can see the unbelievable, like, you know, sort of possibilities that are being offered to us. And but, you know, possibilities that invoke and involve our full participation. It's not just something we can just, you know, passively watch. But, you know, this is a participatory sport that we're all engaged in.
Right. And in a way, it's the most exciting thing that can happen here, this challenge to the self to activate our fullest potential and overcoming the obstacles in our way. And and when you see people have done it, like winning the Olympics or an Academy Award or something, there's a crystallization of all that for all of us.
Yeah, no, totally. And that's, you know, that is, you know, symbolic of what's being offered to all of us to do. So I think it's helpful, and I talk about this in the book, that we, one way of interpreting what's happening is that, yeah, maybe we've chosen, all of us, to incarnate at this very time in history so as to be the midwives to help to birth this realization through our species. And then that all of a sudden adds... Uh-huh.
What's the realization that we're birthing?
Yeah, the realization, in other words, that we're you know, having a dream, or that we can, you know, in a conscious way participate in our own evolution, you know, just what you've been talking about, and that we can actually help each other to actually wake up. It's what I call, we can actually dream ourselves awake. And there's a way, and it's what I do in my groups, you know, 3-4 nights a week. There's a way of hanging out together. There's a way of having relationship with each other just by, you know, hanging out, where we can actually invoke each other's, like, awakened part. And that's available to all of us. And in a sense, that's the real Sangha. That's the real community of the Buddha. And the word Buddha, it literally means the awakened one, the one who's woken up to the dreamlike nature. That's what the word Buddha means.
Well, I think in your sanghas, in your groups, when you people speak the truth and they are able to express to others how they're being reflected in to each other without other people taking it personally, saying, you know, you're triggering this, and then there's a realization that the dream has manifested right in front of them.
Yeah, no, totally. And it's really a cool thing as you cultivate the ability to, you know, to have somebody who they're offering their imagination or their perspective or perception of what you're doing, and instead of just like immediately, you know, like identifying with it or like resisting or contracting or like reacting, you just understand, oh, they're just offering their imagination, their perception, and what a gift, you know, that they're doing that. And then the fact that you then don't get hooked by it, that's a gift not only to you but to them too. So it's an example, it's a small example of how just like being together in a certain way can really help all of us to heal.
Right. We should wrap up soon, but I do have a question from one of the guys at the station. They asked, have you read Aldous Huxley's Island, the story about isolated island natives infected by evil self-propagating idea? Do you know about that?
No, I haven't. I'm not familiar with that particular book.
It sounds like it's perfect
for
what... It sounds like it's exactly what you've written about in a way.
Yeah, I would be interested. So it's called what?
The Island.
The Island.
Or Island. Huxley's. Aldous Huxley. I think it's one of his novels.
Okay, yeah. So I'm writing that down right now. That's great.
I haven't read it either, but Huxley did write The Doors of Perception. You know that book. Which
yeah,
was
no, absolutely. I'm familiar with that. Totally.
But I think this is a novel of Huxley's. And, of course, Huxley was aware of that.
Well, he was really switched on.
Well, he talked about the mind at large, or the greater mind, without even going to Eastern thought. He says we're all part of this greater mind.
Right, and right, for sure.
So he understood. Of course, you know, he did take LSD see at the last stages of his life, I think, you know,
right
before. Yeah, but anyway, that's something else. But I think he understood that this is a dream and that we are, and I think now, and just to wrap up really, but now more than ever, we are understanding that we're dreaming ourselves awake as this, you talk about the sort of Christ energy or the God or the divine energy being infused into all of us. There's so many people talking about that and actually living that. I mean, it's a little new age, it's a little woo-woo spiritual, but there's people that are actualizing that within their perspective.
Yeah, no, totally. And the thing which I just would add to that is that instead of it being these isolated, like, little fragments of people here and there, just imagine, I'm invoking imagination again, but what would happen is more and more of us, like, you know, I'm having the realization and I'm expressing it in whatever, you know, particular way I express it. But then, you know, you or other people might have like a similar insight and be expressing it in your own way. And instead of us being in competition or it being, you know, sort of this disassociated thing and where it's fragmented and having all these like different like sort of compartmentalized things, the idea of connecting and coming together and putting our realization together, that's really, from my point of view, that's the way, because we can all help each other to deepen our realization and to stabilize our lucidity and, you know, to deepen that whole, like, you know, to dream ourselves awake and right, all that. And that's what's really being offered to us, you know, to come together, to step out of the separation.
Well, it's all part of the fractal, all part of, like, the puzzle. You know, in fractals, you can take parts of it away, you'll still have the picture, but the more of the elements of the fractal that you put together, the more detailed and richer the actual hologram or the actual creation becomes.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And any little fragment of a hologram contains, you know, the information of the whole hologram. So that's what I was saying before about any of us could be like seen as shamans, that any of our personal process could be containing in encoded form the entire process of our species.
Right. So you're saying, I mean, what I get that you're saying here in the conversation is like even whatever your situation that may be confronting you, if you see it as not a personal thing, but you see it as a kind of dreaming element. I mean, if you confront this Watego in whatever form it appears and you kind of see it as there in a way to wake you up, then you've already overcome it. Would you say that?
Yeah. Well, right. Right. Well, I don't know if you've already overcome it or that's the first step in overcoming
right.
it. But that, you know, the point. You know, the whole point is that whatever's happening in your life, in your personal life, that's the offering that the universe is making to you. And you have the choice of, are you going to deal with that by being in avoidance and looking away, which feeds Watego, or if you come to terms and are able to add light and, you know, on what's happening both out there and in yourself, then at that point you're being an agent, you know, which is non-locally, you know, affecting the entire universe.
Oh, so the more people that lift themselves out of the Watego curse, in a way, the easier it is for a lot of people to lift themselves out of it.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. Like, even one person doing it at any given moment, all of a sudden, you know, by them embodying that identity of being, you know, free of Watego in that moment, that's in a way sort of like, it's sort of like they're going to a bank, to the Psi bank, the, you know, PSI bank, and depositing that realization into the whole field, which is non-locally, instantaneously getting sort of like, it influences the entire field, and it makes it that much more probable that other people can step into that same realization.
So what does a world look like free of Watego, completely free? I mean, at, you know, starting at ground level, we're working our way up. But when we get there, what do you envision as a society?
No, and I appreciate that. And I want to just, you know, almost throw that right back at you, because it invokes that's invoking the creative imagination. I mean, how would any of us see? It's kind of like as an artist, and I talk about this in the book, one of the things I'm creating as an artist is an art happening called Global Awakening. And when people ask me, oh, what is art happening called Global Awakening? What is it? I right away say to them, well, what would you imagine it to be? What would you imagine if you were to wake up fully and completely and utterly in this dream right now how would you dream the dream?
Nice.
What would it look like?
And so, I would see it as pure joy and bliss, and each moment a new creative sense of adventure. And in a way, I live that way a lot of times, but there's also the part.
Well, that's beautiful. I mean, I support that totally. And it's beautiful that you're not just having like an idea, but you also said, oh, this is how I live my life, because the idea is, you know, not enough. The point is to embody the idea, to incarnate our vision. And,
I live my life that way. But then as I was talking, I see the resistance or the fight or the stuff that comes up that gets in the way of me living that way as well.
Sure. And that's really good to even be shedding light on, because that's one of the most important things, is to shed light on the energies in us that are actually our obstacles. You know, because obstacles like Watiko being an example can only operate with any sort of power via our unawareness of them.
Right. I mean, the image I get is like really moving freely and sway gracefully, but through mud, you know, through like wading through this thing, but it's like movement through this thing. I mean, that was what came to me. And so coming up out of that, you know, in a way it's maybe habitual, that feeling, and I have to kind of get rid of that habit and just go to the lightness of it all.
Yeah, but be careful, because when you're saying you want to get rid of something, I mean, that's potentially a part of you. And so you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater type of thing, you know?
Right.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. And then one other thing, too, just to answer your question even more, when you were saying, how would I imagine it would look like if we all woke up? Or, well, one thing I would say is that, well, when I imagine it, you know, if there's still even one person who's not awake, well, then it wouldn't be fully satisfying. Because if I'm fully awakened, well, what have I recognized? That I've recognized that, oh, my God, I'm not separate from any being in the whole dream, the whole universe. And so it's the idea of like the whole, like the bodhisattva, they're about to enter into nirvana, you know, they become fully enlightened personally, and then they, you know, they see all their fellow suffering brothers and sisters, and they make the commitment of the bodhisattva vow that I'm not going to enter into nirvana until I bring everyone else there first, because who is everyone else? It's just aspects of the bodhisattva. So in the same way, if we fully wake up, well, part of the, you know, what I imagine would happen is that, well, I wouldn't be fully satisfied with that until every sentient being in the whole universe could share in that awakening. If there was one person who was not awake, well, that wouldn't quite be it, you know, be the
well,
ultimate.
Well, because there's only one mind here. I mean, you can't have an awakened psyche if the psyche is distributed through all of us. So if a part of that psyche, right, is still
yeah, no, totally
asleep.
And the thing which is interesting too is that, you know, it only, you know, it's not, that's not to say, oh, we need to like go about and try to convince anybody or awaken all, you know, 7 billion of us or whatever, but it could just be that there's a sufficient number of us that need to really plug in and to awaken. And when there's like a critical mass, just like that sugar dissolved in the water, then it actually will crystallize in a whole global awakening through the collective unconscious of our species.
But the thing I really want people to get, I mean, listening to this interview, is the reality that each of us face every day confronting the Watiko. I mean, it is in our face every day. I mean, yes, of course, we're transcending it, but I just also want people to really get how real the situation you point out in the book is.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. It is something. It's not just some sort of idea or theory. It's not like that at all. This is something. I'm just a translator. You know, this is indigenous wisdom of,
right,
you know,
it's
not only
absolutely
native,
plagued, you know, our lives, our culture, our world, and in a way, everything we do and say and are in our relationships and our jobs and the things we buy in the store and what we watch on television and in the media and in religions and education, it's pervasive. I'm not just saying, I mean, but of course you address the positive side, but it is so real. I mean, I know it's not material, but it is so real,
right,
and so actual that you've done a great service to point that out.
Well, I will take that in, and I really appreciate that. And yeah, no, I really want to thank you for that, because it is something. I mean, like I was saying, this feels like one of the main reasons why I'm here, you know, incarnate on the planet. And all I want is for people to check out the book, because I feel like, you know, people who have read it are saying, or having, you know, they're, it's totally just, you know, their whole minds are being blown, in the sense that it's really like, you know, trying to shed light on something in a very creative way. And as a Westerner, you know, I've done intense spiritual practice in Buddhism, but I'm also a Westerner, and I've really tried to, you know, to find my own voice as an artist and as a Westerner, and at the same time, you know, having, you know, whatever experience I have of, you know, the Eastern contemplative practices. And I think that it really kind of, something comes through that potentially could be of help for people who are open.
Right. No, I think you've done a great job. And the thing is not to dwell on the fact that it is all pervasive, the Watego, but that we are truly the creative artists. I mean, William Blake said it's the imagination that is the human being. So by just keep coming back to who we are as these creative, ultimately imaginative selves that transcend the small ego that wants things and wants its, you know, ideas of relationships and its ideas of money and greed and corporatocracy, you know, that is all evaporated in the face of the creative impulse that comes through that is available to all of us. So,
anyway. Yeah, no, definitely. And like I point out in the book, you know, so many times, it's the creative spirit, which, you know, just remember, like, it's, the creative spirit is encoded in the daimonic, which is, you know, Watego is a daimonic energy, and encoded in it is the creative spirit. And if we are able to consciously unlock that and to access that and express it, express our creativity, you know, then that, I mean, that will, and that is, you know, that is the way of really, you know, the dispel the negative effects of the evil of Watego.
Well, thank you, Paul. This has been a very in-depth interview. And how did you get Sting to read the book?
Oh, well, basically, just real quick, you know, a number of years ago, probably, I don't even know, 2004 or 2005.
I just want to tell people, Sting has a quote on the cover of the Dispelling Watego, Paul's book. Yeah, so a number of years ago.
Right. A number of years ago, I just woke up one morning and there was an email from Sting. And, you know, I remember my girlfriend at the time, she wasn't even, you know, confident that, how do you know it really is Sting? Mm-hmm. But he was saying, like, oh, I'm backstage about to go on a concert somewhere in Lithuania or something. And, you know, I just want you to know, Paul, I love your work and blah, blah, blah. And so we've been corresponding since, and we've met a few times. And
oh, great.
You know, he reads my work. So we're both fans of each other's, I guess.
Oh, good. No, I've met him a couple of times, too. He was connected to Paul Lowe for a while, you know, mm-hmm. who was...
Yeah, he's a beautiful guy, Sting. I mean, he's really just... I mean, I just can't say enough good things about him.
Yeah. He's really into the whole consciousness thing. Maybe I'll interview him at some point, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you, anyway, for everything. And, yeah, hopefully you... We'll talk... Should I give you a call then in the next... a couple of days or something?
Sure, yeah. No, I would be totally happy to talk more, Alan, about me. You know, you were maybe wanting me to come out to New York. That's a real, because I'm from New York, and that's a real possibility. And, yeah, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate your questions and being able to get into a real dialogue. I just so appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's in a way scary. When, as you read the book, you start to sink into the overwhelm. Of course, you then shine the light on the darkness as well. So there's ways through it, but by naming it, you call it out. So, I mean, I can tell you put a lot into this work. I've been talking to Paul Levy in his new book, Dispelling Watego, Breaking the Curse of Evil. His first book was called The Madness of George Bush, which was an amazing book as well, really. That opened the door to a lot of people. So, and if people want to reach you, Paul, or find more of your work?
Yeah, they could just go to my website where they can get autographed copies of the book. and they can email me from my website, and there's a ton of other articles all about this stuff, and it's all the articles are for free, and it's awakeninthedream.com. So AWAKEN inthedream.com. And yeah, so that would be the way, really, of, you know, if you want to get the book or, you know, see any of my other work or contact me, that would be the way.
Yeah, I mean, it's really miraculous work, but it is activating a huge potential of the human being as we really realize that this is the dream that we are here to wake up in. And when you have those experiences, they are like miracles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, definitely.
And you sort of live that way, I would imagine.
Well, I try my best. I mean, you know, like I've been saying, I'm a work in progress like all of us, you know.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for talking here, Paul. I hope you enjoyed it.
Oh, totally. No, it was so fun, Ellen. I really appreciate, you know, your work, and I greatly appreciated this, so I want to thank you a lot, too.
Oh, thanks. Thank you for saying that. So, Awaken in the Dream. That's the website?
Right, right.
Awakeninthedream.com.
Awakeninthedream.com.
I've been talking to Paul Levy. He's an artist. He's a writer. He's in a way, a philosopher, and also a dissecting of our collective soul mind. I would say that's something Paul is. His book is called Dispelling Latigo, North Atlantic Press, Breaking the Curse of Evil, and he goes into what that actually means. Sting says, the world would be a better place if everyone read this book. So thanks again, Paul. I'll be talking to you. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you have any questions or answers, you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net, and you can check my website, newrealities.com. Thank you, everyone there at BBS Radio. I appreciate it. Good night.